Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The U.S. Secret Service scandal is expanding. Agents are now alleged to have caroused with prostitutes in El Salvador, Argentina, and Moscow starting more than a decade ago. Several investigations are now underway. Ronald Kessler is the author of In the President's Secret Service, and he broke the story several weeks ago for The Washington Post when he revealed that Secret Service agents in Colombia had solicited prostitutes. He's also been covering the story for Newsmax.com, where he's chief Washington correspondent. Ron, earlier this week, the U.S. Homeland Security Secretary, Janet Napolitano, said Colombia was an isolated incident, but these latest allegations contradict that claim. In your view, how far-reaching does the scandal seem to be?
I don't think it is far-reaching. I think some of these more recent reports mix up going to parties and going to bars with actual hiring of prostitutes where agents could be compromised. And I know from my book, In the President's Secret Service, that agents really do not engage in this kind of behavior. I do see it as a symptom of the larger management problems, which is a corner-cutting atmosphere, a laxness, which is much more serious because it means that, for example, agents are told that they can just let people into events without magnetometer screening or metal detection screening. That's just like letting people into airplanes without metal detection screening. So, you know, it's good that this scandal, which is the biggest in Secret Service history, is spotlighting these problems, but it's all part of a larger picture.
So you say it may not be that far-reaching, but you've also talked to agents who told you there's a culture of mismanagement throughout the agency. How do they describe that culture?
That's this culture of winking and nodding. They are totally overloaded, overwhelmed. They don't ask for enough agents. They will cut corners, for example. They will not insist on regular firearms or physical fitness tests. And then they cover that up by asking agents to fill out their own test scores. And then they back down to demands by White House staff or campaign staffs to let people in without magnetometer screening. There's a line outside, the event's about to start, and the White House says, let them in, and they let them in. I mean, that alone is just unbelievable. That is the real scandal, and somehow Mark Sullivan, the director, has been able to survive all this.
Ron Kessler, you said something earlier that suggested that, you know, in some cases, these are just agents, for example, going to bars. But there are also allegations that during the Clinton administration, some agents were at strip clubs. Now, that's not prostitution, but it's maybe not quite a bar. Are you saying it should be okay for Secret Service officers in their off time to be at a strip club?
You know, it's not my cup of tea, but I don't see anything wrong with it as long as it doesn't affect their duties or place them in a position where they could be blackmailed. You know, these are not 2-year-olds, they're adults, and they should be allowed to do what they want as long as it's legal and not unprofessional during their time on duty.
How is the Secret Service responding to all this?
Well, they're making a big show of investigating the scandal itself and removing those involved quickly, and that's earning praise from people on the Hill, but that's not the issue. The issue is, why did this happen in the first place? And that's what so far is being ignored. You have members of Congress defending Mark Sullivan, the Secret Service director. You have President Obama defending him, saying he has full confidence in him. I don't know what kind of confidence he can have in someone who's presided over all these fiascos.
Ron Kessler, in your latest article on Newsmax.com, you mention another scandal, this one being Secret Service agents using the agency's car repair service to get their own vehicles fixed, sometimes even before the presidential limos are repaired. Now, this may not be hookers, but that doesn't sound good.
You know, it's part of the same cover-up mentality, and when someone finally did blow the whistle on this, they sent in investigators, some of whom had their own cars serviced for free by Secret Service technicians on agency time, and so, of course, the whole thing was covered up. I mean, again, it was under Mark Sullivan's watch, and it's a symptom of this larger problem, just a total disregard for the taxpayers and for basic security.
How do you see this resolving?
Oh, I think Mark Sullivan will be gone eventually, despite all this support that he's receiving. And that's the only solution. You can't fix an agency by having hearings and having members of Congress sputter on TV. You need a new CEO who can manage properly and restore the agency to the standards it once adhered to.
Ronald Kessler is the chief Washington correspondent for Newsmax.com. He's also the author of In the President's Secret Service. Ron, thank you.
Thank you.
Now, from Secret Service misconduct to military misconduct, there have been several recent incidents. The inadvertent burning of Qurans, Marines urinating on Afghan corpses, the massacre of Afghan civilians by an army sergeant, and the release of photos of U.S. soldiers, some of them grinning, posing with dismembered insurgents. Andrew Bacevich served as an army officer in Vietnam. He's now a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. You can go to hereandnow.org to read his recent Washington Post op-ed on military misconduct. And he joins me in the studio. Professor Bacevich, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you very much.
Professor Bacevich, your piece in the Post was about military accountability, or maybe I should say lack of accountability, because you maintain that it's our top military leaders who should take the blame or at least share it for these sorts of incidents. Is that a fair characterization of your view?
I think it is. You know, as I reflect on the events that are unfolding in Afghanistan, I think it would be a terrible mistake to think that these sorts of episodes of grotesque misconduct happen everywhere all the time. But I think we would be naive to think that the only episodes of misconduct that have occurred are those that have come to light. So we have a problem here. And I am a little upset that the military's response to trying to correct these problems is to lean on the people at the very bottom of the chain of command. I'm not upset that the people at the bottom get leaned on. What I am upset about is that more senior officers seem never to be held accountable for these sorts of events. And if we are going to get this problem under control, we are going to have to concentrate the minds of the generals. And there are times when the best way to concentrate their minds is to fire a couple of them.
We should acknowledge that wartime atrocities have been happening for as long as there is war. But do you think there's anything different or distinctive about the soldier misconduct of recent years compared to previous wars, no matter when or where in history?
Well, you're absolutely correct that war induces barbarism. So any significant conduct that lasts for any significant period of time will, I think, inevitably include episodes of misbehavior more or less like those that we are learning about in Afghanistan. But what makes this situation different is that, setting aside moral considerations, and I don't mean to set them aside because they don't matter, but setting aside moral considerations, there have been wars where misbehavior by U.S. troops hasn't particularly affected the outcome one way or the other. That's not the case with this war. This is a war in which we will never succeed unless we can persuade the Afghan people that our purposes coincide with their purposes. I mean, the cliche used for this is win hearts and minds. We do need to win their hearts and minds. And in that regard, misconduct becomes not simply a moral problem, but it becomes a policy problem.
In your Washington Post piece, you wrote, and here I quote you, "For too long now, command accountability for our troops' misconduct in wartime has been more theoretical than real." By that, do you mean that there is a system in place to hold top brass accountable? We're just not following the system.
Well, there's a theory in place. And the theory is one that says that commanders, and it doesn't specify commanders of any particular rank in this regard, the commanders are responsible for everything that happens to occur within their jurisdiction. And indeed, there has been an effort to enforce this notion of accountability among the captains and the lieutenants and the sergeants when there's misbehavior at a lower level. But with regard to the wartime incidents that occurred both in Iraq and now more recently in Afghanistan, the generals skate. And I think that's a problem. And I think the military needs to recognize that it has a problem. And the military needs to be the ones that act vigorously in this regard.
Now, we are talking primarily about the military, but where is civilian control of these problems?
I think that's a good question. When Secretary of Defense Gates became Defense Secretary, he seemed to go out of his way to try to reverse this growing absence of accountability by senior military officers. For example, when the Air Force lost control of a couple of nuclear weapons or nuclear weapons components, he fired the chief of staff of the Air Force. He fired his four-star Air Force general. When we had that terrible episode of wounded soldiers at Walter Reed Army Hospital being essentially warehoused in totally substandard facilities, Gates fired the Surgeon General of the Army. So there we have a senior civilian, quite appropriately, I think, signaling when there are failures of performance, even by junior people, generals were being held accountable. Now, the problem is that the episodes I just referred to were episodes that happened back here in the United States of America, where there has been misconduct in war zones, in Iraq and in Afghanistan. There, senior officers have not been held accountable. And my argument is that if we really wish to make a serious effort to prevent the recurrence of these sorts of episodes that we've had over the last several weeks in Afghanistan, then we're going to have to apply this Gates standard to commanders who are in the wartime theaters.
On NPR this week, the retired Army Major General Robert Scales, who's a Vietnam combat veteran and a historian, said, quote, "When soldiers get tired and they've been in the field a very long time and the stress begins to build without very tight supervision from small unit leaders, soldiers, remember these are 18 and 19-year-old kids with a camera, go out and do stupid things," end quote. And here's journalist Seymour Hersh talking about the My Lai massacre in Vietnam in 1968 when U.S. soldiers killed hundreds of Vietnamese civilians. This is from a 2008 interview on Democracy Now.
Because what happens inevitably is when you don't see an organized enemy and you lose people, you lose your buddies and your mates and you're angry, you take it out on the villagers, you take it out on the civilian population.
Now, no one is excusing this kind of conduct, but again, keeping in mind that you were a soldier in Vietnam, should civilians have sympathy for this kind of behavior?
Well, as citizens, we should have great empathy, at least, for the soldiers that we send on these wars that are virtually unwinnable and, in the eyes of some of us, also unnecessary. So, yes, in that regard, we should try to understand the circumstances in which they are obliged to serve, but there cannot ever be any excusing this kind of misconduct. And I think the My Lai comparison is both appropriate and inappropriate. It's inappropriate in the sense that the scale of the misconduct in Afghanistan simply does not compare in any way. But the comparison is appropriate in the sense that, yes, here too today, as in Vietnam, we have these long, drawn-out wars in which the stresses imposed upon the soldiers are enormous. But to make note of those tremendously difficult circumstances offers us some understanding of why these incidents occur, but cannot be used to excuse them. Indeed, an appreciation of the difficulty of the circumstances in which our soldiers are serving makes it all the more imperative to hold the senior leadership accountable.
Andrew Basevich is a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. He's also editor of the new book, The Short American Century, A Postmortem. After a short break, we'll have a report from Afghanistan on the challenges NATO troops are facing as they try to fight a war and draw down at the same time. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back. In Afghanistan, the spring fighting season is underway. Insurgent attacks have killed at least 36 NATO troops this month, including one today. The Taliban launched a series of coordinated attacks on Kabul and other cities a week ago. But this week, NATO officials said they're hopeful about making progress in the war and about the Afghan army's ability to take control of security. Military analyst Andrew Basevich of Boston University is with us. Professor, do you share that optimism?
Well, we have to understand that the optimism is expressed with regard to a definition of success that becomes ever lower as time passes along. The definition of success, I think now, both in Washington and for NATO as a whole, is if we can get out around 2014 without having Afghanistan collapse instantly into chaos with the Taliban taking over, that we'll declare that a victory, and we better put the word victory in quotes. Yeah, I think there probably is at least a reasonable chance, by no means a sure thing, that we are going to be able to get out with our forces intact in the next couple of years. I certainly would not bet my paycheck that once U.S. and NATO forces leave that we are going to see a stable Afghanistan, certainly not a democratic Afghanistan, in the years that follow. I think that in that regard, anybody can make predictions, but they are probably equally valueless.
Andrew Bacevich is a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. He's also the editor of The Short American Century, A Postmortem. Next, we go to Afghanistan, where NATO forces are trying simultaneously to fight and end the war. The BBC's Quentin Somerville reports.
In a barren dust bowl in the eastern province of Paktika, an American base is disappearing back into the desert. It's the biggest base yet to close in Afghanistan. It won't be handed over to Afghan forces because they don't have the capacity to keep it running.
Nah, it's sucked back up.
Yeah, we know. Yeah,
quite a big job, no?
No. Of course, I'm lying.
So how long do you think it'll take you to turn all of this back to desert?
After I've seen the project, I'd probably say 3 to 3.5 weeks.
Huge armoured vehicles are being loaded onto transporters. 70,000 odd vehicles will be shipped back to the States. The Afghans will be left with simpler, cheaper transport. Many Afghan soldiers are now literate, though only to primary school reading level. And a school child can't read a mechanical engineering manual, so little equipment will be left behind.
The soldiers that are normally at this base have had to stop patrolling. Some officers are saying that this exercise in removing bases is a distraction. Others go even further and say that you can't wage a war and wind it up at the same time, and that the mission here in Afghanistan is now at odds with itself.
The Taliban attack on Kabul was a reminder that far from being defeated, the insurgents may be becoming more sophisticated. NATO didn't see this one coming. The war here started with a promise to make Afghanistan a better, safer place. But as it enters its 11th year, hope and ambition are on the wane. NATO's senior civilian representative is Sir Simon Gass.
I don't think it will ever be possible, as we've seen in other cities around the world, to ensure that Kabul is entirely safe. And that's why I say that we've seen attacks of this sort before, unfortunately, in Kabul, and I expect that we will see similar attacks in future.
Death to Britain, death to America, chant Afghan protesters. Relations between NATO and the Afghan government are in the doldrums, suffering from setback after setback, including the burning of copies of the Quran by US soldiers and the murder of Afghan civilians by a staff sergeant. Each event, another crack in the partnership. Veteran commanders and diplomats say things have never been this bad before. Western capitals have lost faith in President Karzai. Further east in Paktika, the men of 228 Company are heading out on patrol. The fight in Afghanistan is moving from the south of the country to the east.
We're just walking through some dry riverbeds. It's middle of the afternoon, it's quite hot, and these soldiers really are at the sharp end of the fight against the insurgents here in Afghanistan. They don't do work providing much security for the locals, and they certainly don't do the digging of wells and the building of bridges that you see elsewhere in Afghanistan. This is simply about fighting the Taliban and stopping them getting in here from across the border in Pakistan, which is just over the next line of hills. That fight, though, has got a lot harder, because already this company and companies across this province and across Afghanistan are seeing their numbers reduced.
A third of American forces, some 30,000, will have gone by September, followed by 500 British soldiers by the end of the year. Afghans will take their place, but privately, US soldiers think their partners are unlikely to hold this area. They complain that the command between the Afghan police, army and intelligence service is fractured.
Give me a grid for that location.
These soldiers take pride in being focused on the fight in front of them, but they feel that America has turned its back on this war, according to Lieutenant Archangel Moscato.
It's kind of funny, because when I go back and the people I hang out with, you know, 18 to 24-year-olds, they don't really ask me about the war because they don't really know. They might be even shocked that there's still a war going on. So there is kind of a disconnect back in the States.
Even as combat outpost Kushamund is being pulled down, the Taliban attack, US forces respond. NATO's plans for success in Afghanistan are based on hopes that will likely never become true. That by the end of 2014, the Afghan government will be competent and credible, the army ready, and that a weakened Taliban will want to talk peace. This war is about to enter its toughest phase yet. Foreign troops must battle the Taliban, reduce their own numbers and train Afghans. But the insurgents have to do one thing only, and that is to fight.
Level out the bubbles. Next round.
That report from the BBC's Quentin Somerville in Afghanistan. Next week on Here and Now, Trayvon Martin was murdered in a gated community, and one writer says the insular mentality of those places may have been a factor. Also, how our resident chef gets kids to eat healthy foods. News just ahead, Here and Now. Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The Harvard Art Museums, from Chinese jades to Jasper Johns, Byzantium to Bernini. Learn more at harvardartmuseums.org. And by the Institute of Contemporary Art Boston, with Figuring Color, exploring the expressive power of color in paintings and sculpture, icaboston.org. A former aide to one-time presidential candidate John Edwards is back in court to face questions about secret donor money being used for personal expenses. Andrew Young was the first witness called by prosecutors after opening statements on Monday, and he's remained on the stand all week. Young's testimony is essential to the government proving its case that Edwards directed a conspiracy to use nearly $1 million in clandestine payments from two wealthy contributors to help hide his pregnant mistress. This dates back to when Edwards was running for president in 2008. Edwards denies knowing about the money, and he's pleaded not guilty to campaign finance violations. If he's convicted, he could face up to 30 years in prison. Yesterday, a defense lawyer got Andrew Young to acknowledge that much of the donor money went to build a $1.5 million house for his family, not to provide for Edwards' mistress, Riel Hunter. Reporter Jeff Tiberi has been covering the trial for North Carolina Public Radio. Jeff, for starters, would you briefly tell us if any new revelations came out in court this morning?
Sasha, from a money standpoint, we learned this morning that of the about $700,000 that Andrew Young received to initially be used to hide this affair, just $191,000 of that actually ever went to Riel Hunter. From more of a theatrical standpoint, Andrew Young has been very serious, stoic almost in court. Today, he was contentious and punchy, responding to defense attorney Abby Lowell, almost looking to get under his skin. And at one point, they were talking about a secret meeting in August of 2008, the last time that Andrew Young and John Edwards were with each other. And Lowell asked Young, the attorney asked the witness, so that's the truth as you call it. And Young, who's been very quiet for the most part, just answering yes or no, sir, responded back with, as I call it, it is the truth, sir. And it was almost this Jack Nicholson moment out of A Few Good Men. It finally came to a point in the courtroom. It was pretty emotional this morning.
Well, you know, obviously this is a trial of John Edwards, but it sounds like this has been as much at least this week, a trial of Andrew Young. Do you think that's fair to say?
Absolutely. And, you know, the defense has gone to great lengths to point out a lot of the lies might be too strong of a word, but the inconsistencies with his testimony when compared to his book, when compared to his FBI testimony, grand jury testimony, other statements of fact, presumably, that he has made. And they've done a lot to show that there are some holes in Andrew Young's credibility.
Riel Hunter, this is Edwards' mistress, is also on the prosecution's witness list. She now has a child by John Edwards. Is she expected to take the stand?
She is. We believe that she'll be the last witness called by the prosecution. We don't know that for fact. She has a deal with the prosecution, with the government. She has immunity. She will not be charged in return for her testimony.
How would you describe John Edwards' attitude and demeanor in court this week?
Confidence, political at times. When Andrew Young has been on the stand, he has spent a lot of time staring directly at him. And until this morning, Young hasn't even glanced in his direction. And, you know, typically when the lawyers are conferring or they're going up to the judge, Young has really just looked down at his feet almost. Today, his eyes were darting around the room, and he looked over at Edwards a couple of times. Edwards has been conferring with his attorneys. He was a very successful trial attorney in North Carolina, so he's engaged engaged in the process. He's also turning around often and speaking with his oldest daughter, Kate.
Jeff, this trial has been getting a lot of attention, in part simply because the details are so voyeuristic. But in your view, are there larger and more important political issues involved that mean we should be paying attention?
You know, this, as the defense argued unsuccessfully before the trial, this should be thrown out because there's no precedent for this. They say that if this trial were to go forward, which it now has, and if former Senator Edwards were to be convicted, this could change the face of campaign finance law forever. This changes the precedent, and it could be very impactful for how donations and gifts and campaigns and money is viewed for the next 10, 20, 50 years.
Jeff Tiberi is a reporter for North Carolina Public Radio, and he's covering the trial of former presidential candidate John Edwards. Jeff, thanks for the time.
Thanks, Sasha. I appreciate it.
Coming up, China's appetite for cars and how that's affecting the way cars are made and sold here in the U.S. Back in 30 seconds, it's Here and Now. It was the year of the dragon at the Beijing Auto Show this week. Aston Martin, Smart Car, and Jeep all unveiled dragon-themed cars. Jeep made the biggest splash. Not only did its new car have dragons printed on its hood, door, and floor mats, even the slinky female fashion model promoted it had a dragon tattoo. But will these souped-up cars ever make it onto U.S. roadways? China now leads the world in car sales. Nearly 20 million vehicles were sold there last year. That's promoting car makers to tailor more of their designs to reflect Chinese tastes. For a look at China's growing influence in the auto world, we're joined by Paul Eisenstein of the DetroitBureau.com. He's just back from Beijing, and he joins us from his office outside Detroit. Paul, welcome.
Hi, good to be with you.
Paul, we're seeing this heavy dragon theme because it's the year of the dragon on the Chinese zodiac. How much of an impression do these cars make?
They were quite striking, though some of the models of Chrysler certainly enhanced the look. They seem to be going for a very sexy look as they try to relaunch themselves into the Chinese market. Chrysler actually was the first automaker, its Jeep division was the first foreign maker to build cars in China, but pulled out a few years ago, and now they're trying to go back there again.
You've written that many Chinese car buyers want very different features in a car than many U.S. car buyers. Would you tell us how their preferences differ?
Well, actually, it's not as much different as you might think. They may be more different from other parts of the world. There's a lot of similarities. Chinese buyers, believe it or not, like a lot of luxury. The key difference is that they tend to like to ride in the backseat, particularly upscale buyers. And that means that a lot of manufacturers have to customize their vehicles for the Chinese market. One of the vehicles we saw introduced there, for example, was the BMW 335 Li. L as in long, meaning long wheelbase, which translates into a bigger back seat. And those back seats tend to have a lot of luxury in them. So instead of getting stuck in the back as a sort of penalty box, you have controls over the radio and the heating system and so on. And interestingly enough, these sort of features, more the general upmarket feel that Chinese buyers are asking for in the middle and upper parts of that market, are helping drive what we're seeing in cars that will be sold in the United States, Buick being a great example.
And how do you think that will affect U.S. automakers? Is that going to make it even harder for them to sell cars?
No, not at all. First of all, the U.S. makers tend to be doing very well in China. As a matter of fact, the number one maker over there is General Motors, believe it or not. They outsold the United States. They sold more vehicles in China last year than they did here. And they expect to double their sales to 5 million vehicles a year in China within the next half decade. So they're going very well. Interestingly enough, as I mentioned, Buick is very, very strongly influenced by China. The brand would have been dropped in the 2009 GM bankruptcy were it not for the strong sales of Buick in China, where it is one of the top brands. But what's happened is it's transformed Buick. The vehicles that are now selling over here under the Buick brand are very different from the ones we saw not that many years ago. They're, in many ways, Chinese products. They're sexier, they're better looking, they're better equipped. And guess what? they're connecting with American buyers as well as Chinese.
Paul, you mentioned that Chinese buyers prefer more spacious, luxurious cars. Again, may match sort of American appetites. Europeans, on the other hand, tend to go for smaller compacts, in part because of how Europe is designed. Is there a risk that these bigger cars preferred by the Chinese will lead to the production of more gas-guzzling cars and away from more fuel-efficient ones?
Well, we hope not. For one thing, the Chinese are pushing very hard for fuel efficiency. They're starting to penalize the big engines that Americans have traditionally wanted, and which we're moving away from here as well. They're also heavily promoting electric propulsion, at least trying to promote it. It's been a lot more difficult to sell electric vehicles in China than they would like to believe. But if the Chinese have their way, and remember, it is a command economy over there, they would be selling as many as 5 million plug-in hybrids and pure battery electric vehicles by the end of this decade.
This week, GM unveiled plans for an update to an electric car that looks like an electric rickshaw, but it still seems like China isn't going electric as quickly as it had hoped. Where is China now on that push towards more electric cars?
Well, it's the same thing that's happening in the United States. They're finding it's much more difficult to convince buyers to spend the extra money to go for plug-ins and pure hybrids, as well as more conventional hybrids. So it's a bit of a struggle over there. And part of it is that the technology just isn't ready. But they definitely need to make a transition. One of the things you notice when you're over in China is that the air is as thick as, well, it's as thick as wool. You can barely cut through it with a knife.
The pollution.
The pollution is just horrid. As a matter of fact, in all my dozen-odd years of going there, I've never seen the pollution this bad. So it's clear that the Chinese want to get and will do anything they can to promote electric propulsion. Whether buyers will go for it is another matter, because there is still a price premium over there, even with huge incentives for buyers who do go for these electric vehicles.
Paul, briefly, in the time we have left, I understand that Chinese carmakers are creating cars that are a mashup of foreign and domestic cars. Could you explain that?
Yeah, now what you have are the domestic brands like Geely and Great Wall, and then you have the curious joint ventures that are required by law. So GM, to go over there, has to be a partner with a Chinese manufacturer. Now they're coming up with these even more unusual hybrids. GM, for example, created a company called Baojun, and Nissan and its partner created something called Venusia. And the idea is they're all these second and third tier cities where the next generation of growth could push Chinese demand to 30 million cars a year or more.
Well,
in
that's
just a few years.
That's Paul Eisenstein of the DetroitBureau.com. He's been telling us how the growing Chinese auto market is influencing car designs worldwide. Paul, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure to be with you.
An update on a story that got a lot of attention on our website. Cats will continue to roam free in Concord, Massachusetts. Last night, Concord's town meeting voted down 3 articles by resident Lydia Ledinsky that would have called for the town to hire an animal control officer, require cat owners to vaccinate and license cats, and adopt a program for responsible pet ownership. That pet ownership article actually received an equal number of votes for and against. But in Concord, a tie vote means the article fails. On Monday, Lydia Ledinsky told us she's made this her cause after her neighbor's cats killed many birds in her backyard and her neighbor refused to try to rein the cats in. But today, even after last night's defeat, she's still optimistic.
I received a number of very supportive emails and telephone calls from people who said that they were there. They were sorry that it turned this way, and they actually were wondering if maybe we could set up a different committee of just citizens versus through the town that would look into and investigate the responsible pet ownership program. Hopefully, if we find the right people who are committed to this, there are a lot of things to do.
After we spoke with Lydia on Monday, we were flooded with online responses from bird lovers, cat lovers, and everyone in between. You can see that discussion at hereandnow.org. Back in a minute, Here and Now. Welcome back.
There was a man going to be on the stage just last night. He couldn't make the show. He had a gig up in heaven, y'all.
That's Martin Sexton paying tribute to the late Levon Helm of the group called The Band. This was recorded during Sexton's recent show at the Calvin Theater in Northampton, Massachusetts. Helm had been scheduled to play the same theater, but cancer cut his tour short. He died last week at age 71.
A place to lay my head. I say, Mister, can you tell me when a man might find a bed? He just grinned and shook his head.
It made sense for Martin Sexton to echo Levon Helm because they shared a kind of working man's approach to music. Sexton's career started with street busking and selling his homemade demo recordings, and he's now carved out a comfortable niche and loyal fan base. His latest release is Fall Like Rain, put out on his own label, Kitchen Table Records. He's playing in Philadelphia tonight at World Cafe Live, and next Friday and Saturday at Irving Plaza in New York. Here and Now's Alex Ashlock spoke with Sexton before his recent show at the House of Blues here in Boston.
You were back in Boston, and this is really where you got your start, in Harvard Square.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I sure did, man. What a place to start, too. Some guys went to the Juilliard School of Music. Some guys went to Berkeley. I went down to the subway and started singing down there for tips. And wow, what an education in performance and songwriting that was. It's been a wonderful ride. You know, it hasn't been like a flash in the pan. It's not like I went from the subway to a house of blues. You know, it's been such a journey, a slow and strong growth, and I'm blessed with this fan base. It's not like they're fickle and they like one tune. You know, they're not waiting for any one particular, you know, song. And they bring their friends and they bring their family. And, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've met fathers who've brought their sons or mothers who've brought their daughters. And it's a wonderful, organic sort of career that I'm enjoying.
City never sleeps. Cabs race down the avenue. Little Italy is wide awake.
It sounds like you always knew that music and this was what you wanted to do.
Yeah, I did, yeah. I think my first aspiration was to be an actor. And then I started thinking a little more practically. I thought, well, I'll be a stuntman, you know. I'm one of the youngest of my family, and I snuck up to my big brother's bedroom up in the attic, and he had this record called Frampton Comes Alive. And I put the needle down on it and put the headphones on as a 10-year-old. I heard that crowd and those guitar licks, and that just lit my fire. I knew that's what I wanted to do, man. So I was singing. I started singing in the schoolyard. I'd sing Stevie Wonder tunes or Beatles songs or whatever out in the schoolyard, and kids would gather around, and the nuns would come and break it all up with their sticks, you know. But I knew early on, man.
Have on a feel, have on a fall like rain, yeah. With no shelter so I can feel which way the wind is blowing today. Have on a love, have on a sea for the world, yeah. Gonna tell the truth and feel the sun come shining down on my face.
You mentioned the Beatles, and one of the songs that really stands out for me that you do is the version you did of Working Class Hero, John Lennon. What did performing that song mean to you at that concert?
Well, I was honored to be invited to be on that show because, you know, I'm sharing a dressing room with Jackson Browne. You know, I'm listening to him practice Revolution, and he's listening to me practice Working Class Hero, and Taj Mahal and Keb Mo and Cyndi Lauper, and it was just really cool. I chose that song because it's time to start singing these songs again. That's why I put the Buffalo Springfield cover on my record. I feel like there's so much going on in our world that we need to pay attention to. And that song, Working Class Hero, is so appropriate now. You know, the common man, the working man, you know, as a working person myself, it's incumbent upon us all to pay attention.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small. By giving you nothing instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. Where they hurt you at home and they hit you at school.
Whenever anyone talks about you or writes about you, the characteristic that comes up is your voice. You really do some amazing things with your voice. Did that come naturally?
I think I have a natural sort of talent for musical things. Like I kind of have a good sense of rhythm and I can carry a tune. And I've always, even as a kid, I've always wanted to do something more with my voice than just sing. So I like to use it in different ways. You know, I've been known to scat or even make other sounds with it, you know. You know, like that teacher on Charlie Brown, you know. That was my first sort of introduction of, you know, doing other things. And Mel Blanc, you know, the voice of all the Looney Tunes characters and Woody Woodpecker and everybody in between, he was a big hero of mine. I mean, that's a guy who had 100 different voices, all completely distinct from one another.
Yeah, the Gashouse Gorillas are a bunch of dirty players. Well, I could lick them in a ball game with one hand tied behind my back, all by myself. Yeah, yeah, I'd get up there and wham, a homer, wham, another homer.
On my records, you will hear a gospel choir in the background, and that will be, you know, like 12 of me doing different characters. Or you'll hear, you know, the like Sons of the Pioneer guys behind me, or you'll hear some Soul Sisters behind me, or...
And it's all you.
Yeah, and I like to try to utilize that to give a record some color and character.
One voice singing out, but a full-blown choir can set the world on fire. Let the light shine on forever. Singing in one voice, hey, one voice now, one voice together.
You talked about the Buffalo Springfield song, the cover on the record, For What It's Worth. Do you have a social consciousness in your songs? I'm thinking of Sugarcoating coming after 9/11. But talk more about that song, For What It's Worth, why you wanted to put that on this record.
Songs and music have a duty, a utilitarian duty, I think, to both entertain and inspire, but also to motivate and unify. That's why I wanted to put Buffalo Springfield on this record. I'm starting to wake up. I'm starting to have a conscience and an awareness. And so I feel it's my duty as an artist to include that in my art, not just the love songs or the entertaining songs, but also to bring in some consciousness into them.
So you feel like musicians have that responsibility. That's part of the... should be part of the job.
Yeah, I believe so. I don't want to be known as a protest singer, per se. To me, it's just about being human and reacting in the most soulful way I can.
Something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time to stop. Say, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Stop, hey, what's that sound? Tell me what's going round. This battle line's being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking in minds, oh, getting so much resistance from behind. I think it's time to stop, hey, what's that sound? That sound. Everybody look, yeah. What's going wrong, yeah. Oh, what a field day for the heat. 1,000 people in the street singing songs and carrying signs, mostly say hooray for our side. I believe it's time to stop. See what's that sound. Everybody look, what's going down. Stop. Oh, it's time, y'all. Paranoia strikes deep. Enter your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, know the man come and take you away. It's time to stop, babe. What's the sound? Everybody look, what's going round, babe. Stop, what's the sound? Everybody look what's going down. Oh, oh, oh,
getting the beat of it now.